Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Alice Bryant. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, representatives from the United States and more than 70 countries met in London last week to discuss the illegal wildlife trade. The delegates promised to work together to protect endangered animals. Experts estimate that the trade in endangered wildlife, including elephant tusks, rhinoceros horns, and tiger bones, is worth $17 billion a year. Now, hundreds of kinds of animals are at risk of dying out. Britain's Prince William spoke at the meeting. He said he understood that many countries do not have enough resources for law enforcement officials.
But I am asking you to see the connections, to acknowledge that the steps you take to tackle illegal wildlife crime could make it easier to halt the shipments of guns and drugs passing through your borders.
Illegal ivory trade activity has more than doubled since 2007. It has claimed many human lives. The International Ranger Federation reports that more than 100 wildlife protection officials died trying to fight poachers last year. And rare wild animals have been pushed to the edge of disappearing. More than 1,300 rhinos were killed in 2015 alone. And the number of Asian tigers has decreased by 95% in the last 100 years. Their body parts are in demand for Chinese medicines and alcoholic drinks. But it is not only big mammals that are at risk. For example, the numbers of an endangered water frog from Lake Titicaca in Peru have sharply decreased in recent years. Thousands have been caught to make a juice that some people believe has medicinal uses. There is, however, no scientific evidence to support those beliefs. At the meeting, delegates supported the decision by China at the beginning of this year to close its domestic ivory market. The move is considered a major step in protecting the world's elephant population. Aaron White is with the Environmental Investigation Agency in Britain. He said other animals need similar protection.
This market was both stimulating demand for ivory and also enabling illegal ivory to be laundered through this legal trade. But that same issue still exists for big cats.
Activists say existing UN rules on international organized crime can help fight the illegal wildlife trade. But they say those rules are not being used effectively. United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions told delegates that the U.S. will give $90 million to programs that fight illegal wildlife traffickers. He said, "These criminals must be, and they can be, stopped." The meeting attendees promised to work together to fight the illegal wildlife trade and recognize it as a serious and organized crime. But it remains to be seen how quickly they will act on those words. We'll be right back.
Ian Power was one of the first people to buy legal recreational marijuana in Canada. But he has no plans to smoke it. He plans to keep it forever. Canada became the largest country with a legal national marijuana marketplace on Wednesday. Power was first in line at a store in the eastern city of St. John's, Newfoundland. "I'm going to frame it and hang it on my wall. I'm not even going to smoke it. I'm just going to save it forever," Power said. And there was more good news for marijuana lovers. Canada's public safety minister said the government will consider a proposal to pardon those jailed for possessing a small amount of marijuana, as long as they have finished their sentence. Canada has permitted medical use of marijuana since 2001. For 2 years, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's government has worked to legalize marijuana for recreational uses. The goal is to admit society's changing opinion about the drug and to create a government-supervised market. Profits out of the hands of criminals. Today, cannabis is legalized, Trudeau wrote in a tweet. Uruguay was the first country to legalize marijuana sales in 2017. As Tuesday night came to an end, hundreds of people were lined up at a store on Water Street in St. John's, Newfoundland. Some people smoked marijuana on the street, while those in vehicles sounded horns to show support. "We just made history," said the 46-year-old Power, who bought 1 gram of marijuana. "I can't believe we did it." Bruce Linton, the head of marijuana grower and store Canopy Growth, made the sale to Power. "It was extremely emotional," he said. "Several people who work for us have been working on this for their entire adult life, and several of them were in tears." Linton said Canada is at the head of the industry because it is federally legal in Canada and federally illegal in the United States. The last time Canada was this far ahead in anything, Alexander Graham Bell made a phone call, said Linton. Bell, who lived in the United States, was a Canadian citizen. Linton's company recently received an investment of $4 billion from Constellation Brands, which also sells Corona beer and Robert Mondavi wines. Tom Clark, who sold marijuana illegally for 30 years, was also one of the first to make a legal sale in Canada. His store opened early Wednesday morning in Portugal Cove, Newfoundland. He made the first sale to his father. A crowd of 50 to 100 people waited outside and cheered him. "I've been waiting my whole life for this," Clark said. "I am so happy to be living in Canada right now, instead of south of the border." His father, Don, said he was happy that he was one of the first buyers of legal marijuana. "It's been a long time coming. We've only been discussing this for 50 years. It's better late than never," he said. The Newfoundland stores are among at least 111 legal marijuana stores expected to open across the nation of 37 million people. Canadians also can order marijuana products through websites operated by provinces or private sellers and have them sent to their homes by mail. Two provinces, Alberta and Quebec, have set the age for legal purchase at 18, while others have made it 19. No stores will open in Ontario, which includes the city of Toronto. The province with the largest population is working on its laws and does not expect stores until next year. Each province in Canada has different laws, but they all must meet conditions set by the federal government. I'm Susan Shan.
Sometimes the most common words in the English language can cause the most trouble. Today, we will talk about four adverbs that are often unclear to English learners. All four words relate to time in some way. They are just, already, still, and yet. There are a few reasons for the lack of clarity. Some English learners mistake just and already as having the same meaning. The same is true for the adverbs still and yet. Another reason for the lack of clarity may be that in some languages, a single adverb can have many meanings. In Portuguese, for example, the word já means already and yet, and sometimes just. Whatever the reason, we are here today to lessen confusion around these adverbs and help you use them correctly. First, close your eyes and imagine a telephone call between two friends going to the movies. You will hear the four adverbs used. Think about their meanings and how each is different.
Hi, Sue.
How's it going? Hey, quick question. Should we buy tickets online or at the theater?
Don't worry. I already got the tickets. I bought them this morning.
You're the best. Thanks.
Anytime. Anyway, I just left the house. I'll be at the theater in 20 minutes.
Okay, but I'm still getting ready. And I have not eaten yet. But I'll get a taxi and be there around 6:15.
That works. When I find seats, I'll text you the row number.
Perfect. See you soon.
What did you learn about the four adverbs and their differences? Let's start with the word just. We use just to say that an action has happened very recently or a short time ago. You heard one speaker say this.
Anyway, I just left the house.
The speaker means, I left the house a very short time ago. How long a very short time is will depend on the situation. For example, imagine that you had been going to a university for 4 years and graduated 2 weeks ago. You talk to a family member, and they ask what is new. You say,
I just graduated from college. I'm so happy to finally be done.
The word just was correctly used here because the idea that something happened recently often depends on the time length of the action. 4 years is a long time, so graduating 2 weeks ago is still very recent. The word already is different than just. We usually use already to say that an action has happened early or sooner than expected. Here is the example from the phone call.
Don't worry, I already got the tickets.
Here the speaker means, I got the tickets sooner than expected. His friend Sue did not expect that the tickets had been purchased. The speaker did not use the word just here because they bought the tickets several hours ago, and in this situation, that is not a short time ago. Now we turn to the adverb still. We use still to say that an action is not yet finished, especially if we expected it to finish sooner. Here is the example from the phone call.
Okay, but I'm still getting ready.
The speaker is saying, I haven't finished getting ready. And she probably expected to be ready sooner, especially since the movie starts soon. And finally, we have the word yet. Yet is used for actions that someone is watching for or expecting to happen. Unlike still, with yet, there is no evidence that something was expected to finish sooner than now. Yet is usually used in questions and negative sentences. A negative sentence is one that contains the word not. Listen to the example of yet from the phone call. Notice that the sentence is negative.
And I have not eaten yet.
We also use yet in questions, as in this example.
Have you eaten yet?
No, I haven't.
As you know, in English grammar, there is always an exception to the rule. Although we mainly use yet in negative sentences, we sometimes use the word still. The meaning is very similar, but the tone is different. Listen to two negative sentences. One uses yet, while the other uses still.
She hasn't graduated yet. She still hasn't graduated.
To a native English speaker, the word still here has a judgmental tone. It sounds like the speaker thinks the woman has been in school too long. Here's another example that shows a tone change between yet and still.
They haven't heard from the doctor yet. They still haven't heard from the doctor.
In this example, the word still sounds like they have been waiting a long time to hear from the doctor. They might even be frustrated about having to wait. So, do you have a better sense of these four adverbs yet? Or do you still have questions? Or both? Visit our website where you can practice. I'm Alice Bryant.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Benjamin Harrison. His family name may sound familiar. That is because he was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. That situation is unique in U.S. history so far. Harrison played an unusually active role as president at a time when most chief executives saw themselves as simply administrators. As a result, American writer and intellectual Henry Adams said, Harrison was the best president since Lincoln. But most Americans remember little about him, except his connection to the previous President Harrison, who himself died after only a month in office. Benjamin Harrison grew up on a farm in the Midwestern state of Ohio as one of eight children. His grandfather was not the only famous political Harrison. His great-grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence, and his father had been a congressman. Young Benjamin Harrison respected these men and believed he had a role to play in history, too. He received a good education, and even outside of school, he read many books. His hard work and intelligence carried him to Miami University in Ohio, and then to a career as a lawyer. Along the way, he married a woman he had known since he was a teenager, Carolyn Lavinia Scott. The couple settled in another Midwestern city, Indianapolis, Indiana, and had a son and daughter. Over time, Harrison steadily built a career as a public official. But his political path was interrupted by the American Civil War. Harrison rose to the rank of general in the Union Army. He fought under General William T. Sherman and was one of the first soldiers to enter Atlanta, Georgia, after the city surrendered. Reports say that Harrison was an excellent soldier, but he did not enjoy fighting or find war romantic. After the war, he returned home to Indiana and continued his legal and political career. In 1881, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. But 6 years later, he lost his seat when Democrats came to power in his state. Harrison's loss of his Senate seat soon turned to a victory. The Republican Party nominated him as their candidate to run against Grover Cleveland in the 1888 presidential election. Cleveland's economic policies had become unpopular, and Republicans worked hard to support their candidate. They succeeded. Although Cleveland won the popular vote, Harrison won the Electoral College. In 1889, he followed his grandfather's footsteps all the way to the White House. Harrison's election was a major victory for his Republican Party. In addition to winning the White House, Republicans gained seats in the House of Representatives, held a majority in the Senate, and appointed several Republican justices to the Supreme Court. Harrison and other Republican lawmakers used their power to take action on issues at home and internationally. One act was to preserve forests. Harrison identified 17 protected natural areas and helped create Yosemite National Park in California. His government also established Ellis Island in New York to make immigration to the U.S. a more orderly process. Internationally, Harrison's administration sought to build ties with Latin American countries. His government established what would, in time, become the Organization of American States. His administration also increased the United States' global trade, as well as the country's navy. But, for the most part, the most pressing issues of the day were economic. The federal government at that time had an unusually large surplus. Some argued that the surplus was hurting business. In answer, Harrison's government placed a high protective tariff on imported goods. The legislation was known as the McKinley Tariff of 1890. Officials also aimed to limit the power of large corporations to control important markets in the U.S. Finally, they agreed to require the government to buy silver to use as currency. These actions pleased some of his supporters, but they may have contributed to the severe economic depression that followed Harrison's term. And in general, voters disapproved of the amount of money Republican lawmakers were spending. Although the country was at peace, the 51st Congress appropriated $1 billion. At the midterm elections, many lawmakers paid for all the spending with their seats. 2 years later, voters turned Harrison out of the White House, too. They returned Grover Cleveland to the presidency. Harrison did not express much disappointment. He had worked hard to become president like his grandfather, but he found he did not like being the chief executive. He said, when he left the White House, it was like being released from prison. Among U.S. presidents, Harrison does not have one of the most dramatic biographies. The facts of his life show an intelligent, disciplined man who tried to live by his beliefs. But he was not considered passionate about many things, except perhaps his enjoyment of nature. And he did not have an easy way with people. Even his staff called him the human iceberg, because he could be aloof and act coldly toward people. Yet Harrison's family brought some warmth to his administration. His wife, Carolyn, was known to be a lively, social person. She was the first to install a Christmas tree in the White House. Some of Harrison's grandchildren also lived in the White House. Harrison permitted them to play on the grounds with their pet animals. During Harrison's term, the family kept a goat, which the children called Old Whiskers. Harrison's time in the White House saw sorrow, too. Toward the end of her husband's term, the First Lady became seriously ill with tuberculosis. For months, Benjamin Harrison divided his attention between his wife and his job, and yet in the end lost both. After his term as president ended, Harrison returned to his home in Indianapolis. He did some work as a teacher and lawyer and kept a good public image in his community. He also remarried. His second wife was a widow herself, as well as his first wife's niece. He and Mary Scott Lord Dimmick Harrison had a daughter together. The child was only 4 when Harrison died from pneumonia at age 67.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.